Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Our first annual Seed and Start Fair called Free the Seeds is Saturday, March 19th at Flathead Valley Community College from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. We'll have 18 workshops, 30 booths, 2 films, lots of kids' activities, 2 roundtable discussions on food resiliency for our community, and lots of seeds and starts for sharing and swapping. Come one, come all. For more information, check out freetheseedsmt.com or check us out on Facebook. You can also call 406-471-0022. It's going to be a great time.
Hi, listeners. I am pumped up today to introduce my guest from the Lower Valley Farm in Kalispell, Montana. When I first heard the term gardening CrossFit coined by Kelly Ware in episode 28, way back in the beginning of the Organic Gardener podcast, I've noticed since then several of my guests who have completed some kind of gardening CrossFit challenge this year. Now, I have to admit, second place is going to my husband, Mike, because he has done a ton of work around our place. And I will post a page of the top 10 CrossFit gardening episodes on the organicgardenerpodcast.com. But today, you are going to hear from a woman who epitomizes the essence of gardening CrossFit, the amazing Mandy Girth. So welcome to the show, Mandy.
Thanks. That's an awesome introduction.
Oh, wait, I have more. So I first met Mandy when I went to the Kalispell Farmers Market last summer, hoping to meet some potential guests for my show and see what I could learn. And Mandy just stuck out to me right away because hanging above her head at the rear of her stand is this gorgeous oversized photograph of her children on her farm. And just after purchasing the most delicious cauliflower from her, I got to talk to her just a little bit because there was a long line, and she did consent to coming to do an interview, but she's been kind of shy or super busy, maybe. But I did find her husband on Facebook, and I connected with Jay, and I saw that they were giving a farm tour in 2 weeks. So I marked it on my calendar, but I had no idea what I was going to see that day. So tons of the things that my husband's been talking about, what he wants to do at our place, what he's been dreaming about, were all put into action at the Lower Valley Farm. Like Lisa Ziegler, who I've interviewed a couple of times, was on my case about getting row cover. And so, and my husband's been bugging me for him, but it wasn't until I saw Mandy's row cover on her spinach, like what it really looked like, what I was supposed to get. And like within 2 weeks of coming back, I think I ordered it. And just, but the biggest thing I want to say about that is, like, if there was a Vogue magazine for gardeners, Mandy would take the cover. I mean, this girl is just like the hot, super sunshine. You can tell she's been out working. She's totally toned. She's suntan. And like, just the amount of work on her farm that she's done, like compared to what we have at our place, I can't even imagine getting there. It's like 4 times of the mini farm that my husband planted this year. And she does almost all of it by herself, right? Like Jay handles the farm. I mean, he must give you some help because that's huge amount of work. Plus, you have 2 little kids that you're taking care of. So
well, we have 3 kids. But
you have 3 kids?
Yeah, there's 3.
Oh, my goodness. So I'm going to let Mandy tell you more about how it works. This is probably the longest introduction I've ever given. But congratulations, because you are getting the Organic Gardener Podcast CrossFit Gardener of the Year for 2015 award. Not exactly sure what prize that's going to be, but you definitely win the award. So congratulations and welcome to the show. Everybody's probably like, Jackie, shut up already. Welcome, Mandy.
Thank you, Jackie. You're cracking me up.
All right. Well, cool. I told you it would be fun. It is fun.
It's fun.
So go ahead and tell us. And I haven't even got to mention that we're both artists. So you go ahead and tell us about yourself and how you and your husband got to the Lower Valley Farm in Kalispell and just anything else.
Okay, great. So my name is Mandy Girth, and my husband, Jay Cummings, and I farm together at Lower Valley Farm. We're going into our 5th year this year. We're a diversified 70-acre family farm. So we raise nutrient-dense vegetables, grass-fed Angus beef, grass-fed Cotton and lamb, and we do all that for our community, but we also have a little gaggle of chickens, a couple hogs, a Jersey dairy cow, and we just keep all those for good food for our own family. So Jay is from Montana, and I'm from Indiana, and we met in art school and moved back to the Valley and started farming full-time just a few years ago. So Jay and I have three young children. They're 4, 6, and 8 years old. And we tell people all the time, we're a family farm. And one of the things we try to remember always is that phrase, family farm, the word family comes first. So a farm can just completely kind of swallow you. And our kids are the most important project here. So that's like our first priority.
And yeah, they're getting a great upbringing. I mean, they're growing up in a beautiful place and getting to live on a farm besides just being in Montana. They're very lucky. So one of the other things I remember at your place that I forgot about in the introduction was your cows were so fun. Like, I've never seen cows like so excited to see people, and they came running over and they were just like playful.
Yeah, they're really used to being around people. Part of that, we have kind of two separate herds in the summer. There's the dairy cow that in the summer lives with our Katahdin ram. And at that time of year, there's also a dairy calf. And the chickens are all kind of in rotation together. So they're used to seeing the kids a lot. And then the Angus and the rest of the Katahdin flock are out in the big pasture, which is 60 acres. And Jay actually goes out there every day and moves them onto fresh grass. So they're used to seeing him. So all the livestock around our place is pretty used to being around people. And it is nice for farm tourists because they don't just run away.
No, they were just the most lively, friendly cows I've ever seen anywhere. They just were like jumping and happy. And so, okay. Well, I do kind of always like to start the show asking about like your very first gardening experience. You know, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, tell us about your very, what do you remember the first, the most, the oldest?
Yeah, great. I was, neither of my parents ever had a garden at all. Like, I don't think we even had flowers, just a yard. But I begged my dad for a garden, and he made me like a 4x8 little bed. And I really liked it, but I don't remember if anything grew. I think I had some flowers. I really got started with a vegetable garden when I was in college. And everywhere I lived in college, I always had a garden. But I never thought of it as a career at all. I started really getting serious about gardening after our oldest child was born. So that was like 9 years ago. And as our family got bigger, each summer I made the garden bigger. And we were living in town at that time. And by the time we moved, like every bit of yard was totally full.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. So fruits and vegetables and lots of flowers too.
Now, where was that? Was this in Indiana, or where did you guys go to school? In Indiana.
Okay. This was, yeah, our big family garden was in southern Indiana. That's where I'm from. Mm-hmm. So.
Nice. Wow. Well, that's a great introduction and a great way to, you know, kind of introduce people to, like, it doesn't, you know, how to start small.
Yes. Starting small is a good idea.
And that's interesting because the guy who runs my podcast class always talks about the baby effect. And he says that a lot of entrepreneurs, like, it's strange. Like, you think that when a baby comes along, it would be the wrong time to start a business, but it actually works. He calls it the baby effect because he says then, like, when you have to do it to feed your baby, all of a sudden you're a little more motivated.
Yes,
and making absolutely those phone calls or, you know, getting out there and going to market isn't as scary because you just have a bigger reason for it. But anyway, okay. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what organic gardening or friendly gardening means to you?
I love this question.
Cool.
And there's lots of different ways you could answer it. The first word that popped into my head when I read that question was hope. So to me, organic food, nourishing food, nutrient-dense food means hope to me. You're constantly hearing in our media about all these negative messages about food. Mm-hmm. Everything from small farms fail, the percentage of farms that fail, farming doesn't make any money, to on the consumer end, also a negative message about how it's impossible to feed the world with organics, and also how impossible the alternative is. So you kind of get this sense of things are impossible. But what we need to know is something I don't see or hear in the media. And we need to know that we are in an exciting time for food production, and all the information we need for a totally regenerative global food supply are already here. And there's people all over the world doing something just like amazing. They're choosing to grow nourishing food and build soil. Some as a backyard gardener, some as a career choice. And to me, that's just like, that's amazing. And despite of all this negativity you hear about food, there's people taking it into their own hands and growing awesome food. So when I think of what does organic food mean, it means hope. And you might hear sometimes people say, like, you know, there's no farms. If there's no food, there's no farms, or no farms, no food. But there's no nutrient-dense farms without, like, us crazy nutrient-dense farmers who are so dedicated to soil health and human health. But there also can't be farms like ours without all of these awesome consumers who seek us out. So it's this really beautiful partnership between committed farmers dedicated to growing good food and committed customers who are invested in their food choices. So food choices influence your health, your food choices matter, and when I think of organic food, I think of the power we have to heal with food, and that's such a hopeful message to me. Does that answer your question?
That is just an awesome answer to my question. I love it. It sums up everything that, like, you know, the show kind of, like, I like it to encompass, you know, like the message I kind of want to get out there. And just, you are an amazing person who's out there, you know, growing the food for people. The other thing I have to say is interesting. I just talked to Andrew Malicelli, who, do you know him from the NRCS?
Yeah.
He's in that Western Growers Cooperative.
Yeah, I know.
The first time I heard of nutrient-dense food was, like, when I interviewed him, like, 2 weeks ago. Or, so, I don't know, somebody else is probably like, Jackie, I talked to you about that when you interviewed me. But I've learned so much. Like, I guess I'm taking him for little doses. But I didn't remember anybody. Like, he was explaining to me the difference between red leaf lettuce and green leaf lettuce. And I thought, I just always liked red leaf lettuce. And so I asked him, why are you growing one or the other? And he said, because one's more nutrient dense. And I was like, well, what does that mean? I didn't even realize that some foods, you know, I kind of knew that, like, I've always, you know, something with more color is going to be a little healthier. But do you want to tell other listeners, like, a little bit more about what nutrient rich or nutrient dense means?
Sure. I think if you want to trace the term nutrient dense to its source, you're going to come up with the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is a coalition, a group that supports nutrient dense farming, regenerative farming. So part of nutrient-dense farming is trying to reintroduce the micronutrients back into the soil. A couple ways that you can do that is with, there's lots of ways, of course, but minimal tillage, so that you're not disturbing the top couple inches of soil where most microorganisms live and where they're bringing nutrients into your soil. Perennials, which have deeper roots that can go down and get past that top 6 inches that's really been, where nutrients have been farmed out of the soil. Albrecht was a soil scientist who was interested in deep nutrition, including the macronutrients in the soil, not just NPK. And his research has been very influential, and it's the research that Acres USA is continuing to research, also that the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is based off the work of Dr. Weston A. Price, that the Weston A. Price Foundation is building on, and the work of both Albrecht and Price is hugely influential to lots of new generation farmers like Lower Valley Farm, like Jay and I, and pretty much every little farmer I know. We all want not just to be growing stuff without chemicals, but to be growing nutrient-dense food that's really using the soil and building soil and working holistically with nature, with natural systems.
Perfect.
But of how do we nourish the soil in a more holistic way, where we're getting all the micronutrients that we possibly can into those awesome vegetables or into the pasture so that the cows can eat them and that goes into their meat that we eat, but just with an underlying principle that soil health is directly influencing human health.
Nice. Do you want to tell us who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques?
Well, when I first started vegetable gardening, I always knew, it kind of felt like organic wasn't like it's the right way, it's kind of the only way, you know, like, don't put poisons on your food, you know? And I think that as a beginning gardener, I had the same idea that lots of consumers have, which is organic equals no chemicals, right? And what I've learned, like, in the last 15 years is organic is so much more than that. So it's not just not what we don't do, it's what we are doing. We're doing so much stuff that improves the soil tilth, it makes crops more drought resistant. You know, basically, like, you take care of your soil, and your soil is going to take care of you. And that so much of a bigger thing than just not spraying chemicals.
Awesome. You know, I think you're going to inspire a lot of people that are like, wow, maybe this is what I've been missing before. You know, I just tried to grow stuff without chemicals and nothing really grew. And I was missing that piece about, you know, building up the soil and the different way. And since I've had this podcast, like, I've learned a lot about different ways that you can do it. You know, speaking of Kelly Ware and the permaculture, and you had a hugel bed at your place. That was like one of the first times I'd seen one in real life.
Yeah, we've got a couple. They're just kind of an experiment. And hugel is like a German word that means pile. So it's mimicking a woodland forest ecosystem. We joke around that maybe hugel is actually German for a big mess. And there's a great book out there, I guess an okay book by Mark Shepard called? I don't remember the name of it. Sorry.
Okay, that's right. I'll find it.
He talks about how to take permaculture to a farm scale. Which is a great question, and I read it wanting it to be like some other books I've read where it's really instructing you how to do this on your farm, and it's more of just a great primer really for backyard gardeners to learn more about what permaculture is. It wasn't very instructive as a farmer wanting to do some of his ideas
on the larger scale. That kind of leads right into how did you learn how to grow organically?
Oh, yeah. Great question. So I'm totally self-taught. I don't know if I'd recommend that to other people wanting to be a commercial grower. But that's what we did. And part of that is, you know, we've got three little kids. When we started this, they're really little. And moving someplace to intern probably would have been smart, you know, but
that'd be hard. How would you intern while you had three little kids running around?
It would be so hard on them, just the transition. You know, it's hard on kids to move. And so we kind of looked at it as, okay, our first 5 years, we're going to be our interns. We're going to stay small. We're going to try to not scale up too much too fast. We're going to try to be gentle with ourselves and we're going to try to make this work. So I'm totally self-taught, and I've learned a lot from books. And of course, from practice. And what I learn a lot from is from taking notes and looking over my notes. So like in the last 15 years, I've become a really good gardener, but now I'm trying to do this other learning curve, which is a lot harder, where I'm trying to become a really good farmer.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a challenge, but more and more up to it every year. So
you're doing an amazing job and inspiring and educating. I mean, look at all those people that came to your farm tour. I thought there were going to be like six people there.
I did too. I was so surprised. There were so many people.
And you did a great job. We all learned a ton too.
Well, thanks.
So tell us about something that grew well this year. I know there was a lot of stuff that was growing at your place. Your tomatoes were like the tallest tomatoes I've ever seen in my life.
Are you from Montana?
Yes. No, I'm originally a New Yorker, but I've been here for like 25 years. So,
because like in Indiana, the tomatoes could take over your house.
Really?
Yeah. But we did have a really productive year in 2015, and you know, it warmed up really unusually fast here, and so all the warm season crops, like the tomatoes you saw, the basil was amazing. The winter squash was just great. The eggplants and peppers, everything that loved heat did a lot better than it usually does here. And we actually got to harvest melons, which is always exciting in Montana. So we had a really productive year, great yields, and especially on those warm season crops, they did really great.
Okay. Is there something new or different you're excited to try this next year?
Well, this is our fourth year, and there's so many changes we make each year. Mm-hmm. This year, our primary focus is on efficiency. So we're attempting to keep that same level of production that we had last year, mm-hmm. which I don't think I said. We do 2 acres of intensively planted vegetables.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, that's 2 acres.
Okay.
So and our goal this year is to work, this is ambitious, is to work 20% less hours total than we did last year with the same yields, the same sales, you know, mm-hmm. just less hours. So right now we're looking over all of the tools we have, our seeding and harvesting and sales, and trying to make everything more efficient. And so we were joking just the other day, like, our farm, our practices are really sustainable for our land. And 2016 is the year we want to have a sustainable workload. You know, so this is the year we want to be sustainable, like as a human. So that's our goal this year. That's our new thing, is sustainable workload. We'll see how that goes. Call me and bye. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, because, see, now I understand. Yeah, because too, it's more, because we only planted like a quarter of an acre to like a third of an acre. So mm-hmm. you're like 8 times what we did at least.
Yeah, each of our...
my listeners are probably laughing. They're like, yeah, Mike did all the work, Jackie, we know.
Each one of our garden plots, we have the plots in different sections, and that's each a third of an acre. So okay. We have 6 of those.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about like how you came up with that? Like, how'd you pick a third of an acre for each size? What do you like?
I totally stole that. Yeah, that's a great question. I basically stole that from, I'm probably going to kill his name here because I'm a Hoosier and this is a French name, but Jean-Martin Fortier.
Uh-huh.
The Market Gardener book.
I think that was perfect. I've heard lots of people recommend that book.
Yeah, it's a great book. And so we basically used his system where you use these third of an acre plots. Everything's standardized as far as the size, the row length, they're 100-foot rows. And what that does is that when you're ordering stuff, you're working off of 100 feet. So all of our drip irrigation's on 100 feet, all of the row covers at 100 feet. You know, it's really smart. And then when we get our to scale map out, and I'm doing my planning for the year, because as soon as something comes out, we're putting another succession crop in. it makes the planning so much easier to be thinking of these beds as, you know, these third of an acre areas rather than like, and here's 100 feet of lettuce randomly next to the onions, and now I can't water my lettuce while my onions are curing, you know? So we plan all of that out in the winter. It should be done now. I'm still working on it. We put a huge amount of planning into the garden beds and the crop rotations and the succession plantings so that we never have too much at once, and that we have something really interesting, like eight really interesting things to go in our CSA boxes each week.
Eight interesting things. Now, how many CSA boxes do you do with 2 acres of food?
Well, we're only doing 50, but people... part of our 2 acres is corn, potatoes, and winter squash. People who are just like not doing corn, potatoes, or winter squash, I've heard of CSA farms that have up to 200 shares on 2 acres. Mm-hmm. So, like, I haven't visited those places in real life, but I've heard that it's possible.
Now, you do the farmer's market, too. How come you don't just do a CSA? Do you like going to the farmer? Like, what's, do you get more money from doing the farmer's market? Or, like, what makes you go through all that? Because that can be a lot of work just in itself, just setting it up and being ready.
It's so much work. Yeah, the market is so much work, and that's a great question. What's really nice about doing CSA market together, because some people, like, there are farms they just do CSA, mm-hmm. there's specialist farms where they just do market. What's nice about doing both is, like, I want to always have, there's like 12 things I always want to have at market. But you know what? If there's aphids in my lettuce and I don't take lettuce to market, or if my lettuce bolted or whatever, no big deal. It's market. Somebody else there is going to have lettuce mix, right?
Oh.
So with the boxes, with the CSA box, each week I want to have a salad green, a braising green, some kind of allium, something from the onion family, some kind of root crop, and then I fill the rest of the box with all these beautiful seasonal things. Whereas market is nice because whatever I've got extra of from the week, I take it to market. I'm not just, like, putting 500 bundles of kale into my CSA shares. You know what I mean? The weeks when I have a bumper crop of, or just a huge amount of summer squash, we'll take that extra stuff to market instead of bogging down our poor CSA shares. They work really well together. So at market, it's awesome because sometimes it's so busy you just, like, sell out right away. And some days you take that same value worth of stuff to market and it rains, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's part of market. And then on the other hand, with CSA, you've got your dedicated customers that are always there. But what if it hails, right? So the two kind of nicely complement each other.
Nice.
Yeah, they work well together. And then hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll be adding some wholesale into that too. But right now, just market and CSA is a good fit for our size and for our work capacity.
Well, you just dropped, I don't know, what should we call them? The other podcasters call them golden nuggets, but you're like more like golden sweet potatoes or something. But just, like, great information. Like, nobody else has really broke down what does come in a CSA box. And, like, that you think about it that way. Like, as a leafy, you know, one leafy thing, one root thing, one allium crop, one...
Right.
You know, I really like the way you put that together. That's probably helping a lot of listeners think about, you know, getting started.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Do you want to tell us about something that didn't quite work the way you thought it was going to this season? Something that didn't come
out
the way you were hoping?
Yeah, there were things that didn't work this year. So also with that heat we had,
uh-huh.
What really messed us up last year, like our biggest, like, oh man, was we do so almost everything from transplants, and that's because we're planting intensively and we're working on pretty high production from this amount of acreage.
Mm-hmm.
So putting stuff in by transplant, stuff's not in the beds as long, right? So usually in May, if setting out transplants here in Northwest Montana, it's the perfect transplanting weather. It's cool. We get this like misty rain for weeks on end sometimes, and it's overcast. Great transplanting weather. This year, if you remember, it was just hot.
Yeah.
It didn't rain, and it was sunny every day. So that's not ideal for studying out transplants. And if I would have had a crystal ball, we would have direct seeded everything, right? But we didn't. And we have a plan, and we stuck to the plan, and we lost a lot of transplants. And we also, our first planting of all of our early greens did great. They're fine. But the second planting, which by second planting, it goes in 3 weeks later.
Okay.
But our second planting of greens just bolted. Yeah. So there's like a nice solid layer of bolted bok choy in our compost pile. Oh. But there's, you know, it's part of it. It happens. And what we did this spring that we were able to save a lot of our spring greens from that heat is that we kept stuff covered with row cover. And we watered a lot, and that moisture helped keep stuff cool. We watered a lot this year, so the watering helped. But, you know, you're going to lose stuff every year. And the big challenge this year wasn't a late frost. It wasn't an early frost. It was our challenge was early heat. We weren't ready for that. So
yeah, and we might have it again. I mean, it's February, and our place is practically, the snow's almost gone. I can't believe it. I mean, we had like, you know, still 2 feet of snow in the yard, it seems like, last week, and I'm looking out there and there's more brown than white for the first time, and I'm just really surprised. Yeah, because it's still February. And driving down to Whitefish, going through Olney in the Stryker area, where there should still be a good 3 feet of snow, it's gone.
Yeah,
so I'm a little nervous, but
you never know, it could still snow on Easter.
Yeah. And then we did get some rain in July, I think, finally last year. That was kind of unexpected. Instead of our typical June rains, I think we did get a little moisture in July or August. I don't remember, but sometime during the summer it did finally rain.
It was a record-breaking drought year for sure.
Yep. The last few years, I think, have been record-breaking heat in Montana.
Yes.
We've had like the last 5 years in a row of all broken, big, warm and dry. But last year for sure. I was going to say something about asking you. I like the way that you talked about, like, so now you can predict the weather. Like, if you were going to do it again, would you, like, as you saw that it was drying out, instead of putting your second planting of, would somehow you do some kind of seeding thing instead of transplanting? Or is there just, like, not much you can do because
I still plan on the transplants because I had them. I did actually go in, I think, the first week of June when a lot of stuff bolted before I thought it would. And I reorganized my rotations one evening, like for the year. So we were able to push, like, clear out some beds that we were expecting to be there through mid-June. And we just direct seeded more stuff. So yeah, it worked because we have the ability to overhead water. Otherwise you couldn't have kept, I mean, this year it was like you would water and then the water is just gone. It's crazy. Yeah. You know, like it. Yeah. So
we dug that was the big thing when I came back from your place. I looked at my husband because we dug a 560-foot well 2 years ago. So we're like finally, like after just having a little bit of water, hauling water, not being able to garden, 2 years ago we finally dug this well. And then one of our wells was dry, it seemed like every 3 days last summer. And I was like, if this new well that we dug is dry, doing this little quarter of an acre, how are we ever going to expand to something your size? But I'm hoping there was some kind of leak and the guys finally came in the fall. And I'm hoping that was the problem. I don't know. We'll find out this year. But yeah, a lot of water. The other thing I was going to ask you, so now I have two questions. Well, one was we had a lot of stuff bolt in the early season, but then our fall crops of spinach and things were way stronger than we've ever had. Like in August, late August, September, we had really sweet spinach and it just came back from the seed. Like I just didn't pull it and it just came back.
Oh, great.
So did that happen for you?
Well, since we are kind of on a schedule and I need all my plantings to be on a similar that needs similar things, like they need water, they don't need water, they need to be covered in the fall or they don't, like keeping those things all together. If I have like half of a planting germinate, then you have to kind of decide, well, do I want to keep this or am I just going to do the skin? And so we did have some really nice fall crops. We also had some not as nice fall crops. And what I did is I decided to keep that whole 1,600 bed feet, you know, so 1,600 foot rows. All the stuff that didn't germinate well, I just, those rows, I kind of marked them off with flags and I planted, I overseeded a cover crop there. Since I had it there already, just like a crop that's just there to add nutrients back into the soil. So I decided to keep, and it was, most of it did pretty well, and everything we had in the fall, our lettuce, arugula, our salad turnips, the beets, I guess that was our fourth planting of carrots, some winter radishes, they all did well. That planting of spinach, I think, didn't do so well. And so, yeah, I just planted, since I knew I'd be watering all that, instead of letting the weeds come up in that section and take over, I overseeded, I think, oats just to be there. And then when we cleared that bed out in the fall, we can let the chickens and pigs kind of run through it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, if you're growing for market, you're going to want 120 days between the time you've got livestock on any bed and the time you are going to be working in there again, just as a food safety thing. So the fall is a good time, if you are growing to sell things, to let livestock in, if that makes sense. So
I have not, nobody's really talked about that, but somebody talked to me like in a conversation somewhere that kind of brought something up, and because I didn't have to worry about that, I wasn't paying much attention, but now I guess we got 4 sheep last fall. And then we just have a few chickens right now. We're going to get maybe more chickens down the line.
Yeah. And you know, if you're just gardening for yourself, then honestly, like I don't see any problem if you are pretty confident about your immunity. I don't see any problem having livestock in there all the time. But
they can't get into the, well, this is the first year the chickens have had access to the garden, and I'm sure that's going to get shut off before summer start, before Mike starts planting anything. Yeah. Always they've been like, they've had their cage, and then the sheep are out like on the edge of the, they have their own, what do you call it, pasture or paddock or something. So they're not actually in where the garden is.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. Do you want to tell us about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time?
Oh, yeah. You know what's really great about growing vegetables in Montana that I think lots of Montana gardeners might take for granted?
No.
But for me, being from somewhere that's a lot hotter, is just the amount of the year that you can grow awesome lettuce is really amazing to me. It's like, you know, it's really cool. So the ease with which you can grow greens here is great. And another thing that's really great about being in Montana is that we have so few pest problems. You know, it makes organic gardening pretty easy. You know, we don't have that many bugs. So if you call me in August, I might not feel that way, but sitting here in the winter, I'm like, yeah, bugs are no problem. At our place, we have, you know, we have some slugs, especially because we mulch with hay a lot. We do a lot of mulch, so we do get slugs. But it's not like they're taking out our crops. They're just there. And then we also have a small amount of flea beetles, and I'm getting more acquainted with their life cycles and able to know when they're going to be out and to cover with row cover.
Oh, really? Awesome. Yeah,
but they, if they're under there, then you're creating a perfect environment for them to just propagate. So that only works if they're not there. But our biggest problem with pests is cabbage moths. And they're really pretty reasonably managed with row cover. So, you know, when I remember the types of pests we had in Indiana, I'd like bring my lettuce mix in to wash it, and there'd just be stuff crawling out of it when you submerge it in the water, hydrocool it. And here it's like, oh yeah, look, there's three aphids in that 20 pounds of lettuce. it's amazing. So yeah, I love how easy it is to grow greens, and I love the lack of pests. And as we are, you know, the longer that you do garden without chemicals, and the more perennial flowering things you have around, the more trees you have, the less pest problems you're going to have. So the longer you do it, the easier it gets. And that sounds like one of those, you know, we're all sitting in the field singing Kumbaya or something, but it really, it happens. I saw it in my old garden, and that was in Indiana, where everybody's got hornworms, you know, like anybody who's growing tomatoes, you go out in the morning every day if you're doing organic and just pick them off, and it's disgusting. And by the time we moved, we had no pests because the predator bugs had had long enough for their life cycles to catch up with the bugs that eat vegetables, and it was working, and it's a real deal. So the longer we're here, hopefully the less problems we'll have with bugs. Because we do lose some stuff. We have some root maggot, flea beetles, but it's not too bad.
Excellent. That's another great thing that you mentioned, that, you know, people who maybe are new to organics don't realize, like, you're not just going to put those bugs out. You know, you're not going to plant some beneficial type of pollinator plants and just bring in these pollinators and they're going to just fix your garden that very
like
first
tomorrow.
Season. Yeah. Like tomorrow, like if you're going to spray a chemical or something on it, which doesn't even like this one guy I talked to was really funny. He's like, when I first started, I'd heard so many bad things about chemicals. I got this job once and they were like, "Oh, you're going to go out and spray." And so I went out and I sprayed and everything didn't die right away. So I thought I must have done it wrong. And I went back out and did it again. It's just the funniest story. This guy's like first farming job, and he gets and like, you know, he didn't really know much. He'd like hadn't grown up around gardens, and like his first experience was organic, and then his next experience is like on a chemical type of, you know, regular big farm. And he said it was really funny. He expected everything to just fall over and die right away because he'd heard so many bad things about the toxic chemicals. So maybe if there's other people out there, I mean, you've talked about a lot of things that I didn't know already today. So I think that that's a good thing, an inspiring thing for people, that's going to take a few years, but that you're going to get there eventually, and that the work's going to get easier.
So, it does. It's like you put in more at the beginning, but over the years it's going to get less and less inputs. And the exact opposite's true with, you know, quote unquote conventional or chemical, where each year you're putting more and more on. So yeah, it's initially more of an investment, but over the years it gets easier.
Yep. Excellent. All right, how about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in this Montana climate that you love? You're going to have everyone moving here, which is great. It's a wonderful place.
Well, I liked that question. And okay. Really, as a home gardener, your advantage is that you're doing something on a really small scale. So I say if there's something you love and you're a home gardener, and say, let's say you love artichokes, I'd say go for it. Or you love heirloom tomatoes. Okay, like the big German ones. They're really hard to grow here. I love those. But if you like those and you've got like a south-facing brick wall protected on cool nights, and you're going to get a nice crop, and you're going to have the best tomatoes you can get in Montana, you know? And that goes for any other fussy or hard to grow thing. Like if you want to keep a potted fig plant or a dwarf potted citrus tree that you bring inside in the winter, you know, they're tricky and they're difficult, but on a home scale, that's really satisfying to grow something you love. So if something you love to eat is also something that's really hard to grow, I'd say try it, but also do a lot of things that are going to set you up for success. And mm-hmm. here, that's like I said, the greens, also peas do so well here in the spring. And then zucchini and beans in summer are two of, like, really no fail. You try them, you're gonna do it. You're gonna do great. And then herbs, man, culinary herbs are like, if you're getting started with home gardening, that's a great place to start. Because if you cook, and I think every gardener cooks, they're the most bang for your buck, the most bang for your space. They're easy, they're prolific. It's
and I'd the say, bees love them.
Yeah, there's
bees
just
and
all kinds
just
of good.
Butterflies and just any kind of like those beneficial insects really love herbs. That's interesting. I was just telling my friend Dacia, because she makes aprons, and I was like, you should come on my show and talk about your aprons, because I never really thought about it before, but how about you? Every one of my listeners cooks.
Yeah. And, I bet they do.
Yeah. And she could talk about healthy eating, because she grows a little garden, but she's a really healthy and like feeds her kids all, you know, somehow she manages on this tiny budget to feed them super healthy, all organic. Yeah. Like I was yesterday, I'm there, I'm like, how do you live without a microwave still? And just one of those type of do everything from scratch cooks.
Uh-huh.
But yeah. Okay. So tell us about your, is there like an activity that's your least favorite that you got to kind of force yourself to get out there and do?
You know, my least favorite of anything is the thing that I've put off. So then it's like harder to do it than it should be, mm-hmm. which is really easy for that to happen in a garden, right?
Yeah.
So anything, and that could be like when the weeds get too big and then you're using the bigger hoe instead of the nice little hoe, or transplants that aren't really healthy anymore because you waited 2 weeks too long and you're still setting them out. That's not a happy thing. or things that are growing too slowly because you didn't thin them when you should have. Or like trellising tomatoes when they get too big. Those are my least favorite things to do.
Excellent.
Yeah.
A lot of us are just shaking our heads going, yep, I know that feeling. Yep, that's happened to me. Yep, yeah. I remember that. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you're right, because you gotta always like you're always making these priority calls. Like, is that a priority
yes.
call? If I go one more day, and then like some days I'll go over the summer where it'll be like 4 days where I won't see the garden. I'll go down there. But sometimes it seems like I can go back 2 hours later and the things have grown. You know, during those like super hot days in the middle of August, you're just like,
yeah.
Wow, look at that stuff growing. And
yeah,
it's prioritizing and, you know, getting, like you said, you've been there for a while, so you're starting to see those changes and starting mm-hmm. to recognize when the bugs are coming or what's happening, and big learning curve. Okay, so then on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
Then my favorite activity would be the exact opposite, and that would be when I've got stuff timed just right and it feels good to be, you know, trellising the tomatoes because they're the exact right size. But the most favorite example of that is something I just really figured out last year, even though I've done it lots of years, and that's using the flame weeder.
Oh.
And I've used a flame weeder for pre-emergent weeds in our paths for years, but this year I finally figured out this pre-emergent flame weeding of longer germinating crops like carrots. And this is such a game changer for us because we sell a lot of carrots. And as every gardener knows, homegrown carrots are amazing and they're a big seller at market. our customers love getting them in their box. They would love to get them every week. Having a more efficient way to do the carrots is awesome. So what that looks like is we get a bed ready to be planted 2 weeks before the planting goes in. And you just let that stale bed sit there for 2 weeks. Then you can flame weed that, and you're getting all these little bitty teeny tiny weeds that you can't even see until you hit them with that flame weeder, and then they're just dissolved by the heat. And then you plant your carrots, okay? And you water them, and depending on the heat, it 4 to really pushing it, if it's really cool and overcast, would be somewhere between 4 and 10 days after planting, before your carrots come up, you flame weed them again.
Oh.
Yes. And that's where you really hit the jackpot. But what I had done so many times before is either flame weed it too late and you kill your carrots. That's sad. Or not kind of be too conservative with the pre-emergent flame weeding, and then your carrots and the weeds are all emerging at the same time. So this year I finally kind of got it figured out, and that's just like a beautiful, that now that's like my favorite tools when I do that right with the flame weeder.
Cool. Nobody's talked about that. I'm pretty sure I would remember a flame reader. Flame weeder.
Yeah.
Can't guarantee it, but
for a home gardener, you can get just like it's on one stick, you know, and you can just like have a partner with you with the, like the 5 gallon thing in a wheelbarrow behind you. That's probably the most do it yourself kind of way to get started doing flame weeding. People who try it and say it doesn't work were probably trying to do weeds that are too big. This is really for a teeny tiny, like can't even see them yet kind of guys. Teeny tiny.
Oh, okay. All right. Something we'll have to try. All right. And then, so then after you get those weeds out of there, the carrots come up and it's just carrots growing there, and you don't really have to weed too much after that.
You've still got some weeds. We're doing, you know, all hand weeding still at this scale.
Wow.
So let's see. And I mean, with hand tools, not mechanized weeding. So I bet before we got the flame weeding figured out, I'd have to go back and look at my notes, but I would just guess that we would have spent 8 hours per 100 row feet weeding a carrot bed. You know, we weed them 3 times before we start harvesting. So now I think that's taken it probably down to 3 hours per 100 row feet.
Wow.
Since we do 300 row feet at a time, that's the kind of thing where you're really seeing, that's huge.
Yeah. That's cutting it like a third.
Yeah. It makes growing carrots for market something that starts to be like, okay, I can do this, instead of, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this? You know what I mean?
No, I don't know how you do any of it, to be honest with you, Andy. Like I said, my husband's the gardener. I just, I'm lucky I can put some sunflowers and got them to grow last year. What's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
That's a great question. You know, I'm really self-taught, and when I was really just starting to get serious about gardening, my favorite book was The Garden Primer, The Garden Primer by Barbara Damrosch. It's a really easy to read. It's like she's talking to you, you know, and just pretty much everything in there. But I think I remember this being from her, is that you gotta think like a plant. I love that. And I think that was from Barbara Damrosch, because I read that book so many times when I was starting out. I haven't honestly picked it up for probably 5 years, but, and she goes more into it about, you know, with water and what the plant needs from the soil, but it's pretty good advice to be thinking like the plant, you know, don't plant something when it's not time to plant something. Make sure it gets water. Make sure to protect it from pests. So,
yep, I'm guilty of all those things. Especially, I'm always like in the middle of December. I'm like, can I plant a basil plant now? I'm out of basil. So, yep. Okay, how about a favorite tool that you like to use? If you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without? Is there something you brought from Indiana?
Yes. And the thing I brought that I'm the most proficient with is our broad fork, which is this kind of like, it looks like a pitchfork, but it's intended to go in the soil and kind of, I'd say anybody with a home garden and your home garden's under half an acre, throw away your rototiller and like turn it into scrap metal or something and get a broad fork. It's this, and you just use it to kind of aerate the soil in the fall.
Okay.
So you stick it in and you lift it up. And then you go, depending on what's going to be there next spring, you like do either every six inches or 12 or 18, where you're just kind of aerating and lifting the soil so that earthworms can be really active in the wintertime. It's a pleasure to use. Now that we're on a bigger scale, I still use it, but if I could only take one tool with me, I would take our new awesome BCS walking tractor.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because we invested in it. It's a huge investment. Whereas the broad forks, you know, it's a $100 tool. So, yeah, but I love this walking tractor. And anybody with a home garden, depending on how much time you want to spend in your garden, once you get around an acre, a walking tractor is a good idea. And there's no physical way that Jay and I, with just the two of us, without having interns or a crew, there's no way that two people could be farming 2 acres intensively without this tool. Like, I just don't, there aren't enough hours in the day. The BCS tractor looks kind of like a rototiller. Like, sometimes people that who don't know will think that's what it is. So that's just the shape that it looks like. Mm-hmm. It's got two handles. It's got a crazy powerful engine. And
it has an engine.
Well, yeah, it's very, very powerful. It's a really awesome tool. I saw it at the farm tour.
But I probably didn't know what I was looking at, because somebody since then came on my show and I was telling him my husband wanted a tractor, and he was saying that's what he should get, is yes. one of those walk behind. But yes. it has a motor anyway.
I guess I don't remember. Yeah, it's got a motor. It's like 12 horsepower. Hmm. It's crazy. Okay. It's a really powerful tool. So it's got a power takeoff, you know, the spinning thing, the PTO, just like a, you know, a tractor that you sit on. And you can buy all these different things to hook up to it. So we have a flail mower, a power harrow that we use instead of a tiller. And that, instead of doing deep tillage, it only goes down about 2 inches. And it doesn't mix the soil. It, like, rotates in a way that doesn't mix the soil as much, which is really great for minimal tillage. We also bought the plastic mulch layer, which is awesome. And we've got this rotary plow, the Berta plow, that makes raised beds. Oh. Yeah, it makes raised beds without disturbing the soil in a very intense way. So it used to take us with the biggest hoe ever, which is a great tool for home gardeners to have, is the grape hoe. It's like a bigger hoe. It's also really easy to blow your back out with it, so be careful with it. But it's it's what we used to use to make raised beds. And Jay and I, you know, we're both pretty healthy and in good shape, and it takes us about an hour to make a raised bed, a 100-foot raised bed. This Berta plow in a morning, like 6 hours, we did 32 rows.
Wow. So
just, it's amazing.
32 rows?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, now, right?
If you're, like, because, like, a lot of our land is, like, you know, forest right now. Like, he's got to cut down the trees, pull out the stumps, and, like, and then he's starting from scratch. Like, is that even strong enough to dig up? Like fresh, like never been gardened before area?
Okay. When we're starting a new bed and pasture, there's a lot, and for lots of other jobs on our farm, we hire out tractor work.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So if you're starting a totally new bed, I'd have, depending on the soil, what was there before, you're going to want to get it cleared out. In the fall, you might want to have somebody with a big tractor come and disc harrow that a couple times, just to get it broken up. And then just to get things started, you can use like the biggest rototiller ever once, you know, just to get things kind of where you're going to be able to work the soil. And then after that, the BCS will be your appropriate tool.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Yep.
Yeah. You know, part of their wonderful American individualism is we want to be able to do everything ourselves. And whether you're a small farm or a big homestead, big homesteader, farm, garden, whatever, like, if you can kind of breathe into the space that sometimes you're going to ask somebody with more equipment for help and to pay them to do that, it's kind of a nice thing to realize, you know, that, like, when are we going to need a big tractor? How many times a year? 3 times a year. To turn compost with their bucket loader, to move all the piles of manure around in the spring, to get them in one central pile, and to do some, like, anytime we need to break up sod for new beds. And that's really it. So do we need that tool? Not right now. Now, when would I want that, a bigger tractor? For me, for our farm, I'd say if we were going over 5 acres of vegetables, then we would. Mm-hmm. And then I'd want, you know, tractor-mounted weeding implements, a basket weeder. Yeah, but in kind of the 1/2 acre to 2 acres of intensive, the BCS is a really nice tool. And it's a tool that if and when we do scale up, we're still going to use it. We're going to use it in our hoop houses for all the lettuce beds. It's really an awesome tool. So great tool for
awesome.
Home gardeners, big homesteaders, and small farms. Yeah.
Do you want to tell us anything about the hoop houses? Because we just like, so when I talked to Andrew Malicelli, he talked about the application deadlines to get assistance, and so I got the application in just yesterday, because yesterday was the 19th, we're talking on the 20th, to apply to get some of those high tunnels. So like my husband asked me about that, how do you even put them up if we get approved and we get to do a project like that, like what's
right?
That like you use a tractor to put them up?
No, but we're probably not the best people to ask, Jackie.
Oh, okay.
We've only done one of the big ones. Ours is 30 by 100 feet. And it was one of these things where like, oh yeah, we've built lots of things. This is going to take us. Anybody listening to this who's done this is going to laugh. We're like, oh yeah, this will take like 20 hours. It was a lot more than that. So yeah, the putting up the hoop house is... We will do more of them in the future, and I'm sure every time you do it, you get better at doing it. But it's also something that if you're not able to put it up, the NRCS can let you know who you could hire to do that for you.
Mm-hmm. I don't think ours are going to be that big.
Yeah.
I think he said they were going to be like 20 by 20.
Oh, great.
So that sounds
a lot
smaller.
That's a really, that size... like Jay can build one of those in an afternoon.
Oh, really?
It's in a size that's really easy to pull that big piece of plastic over. It's pretty manageable. Those go together pretty fast.
Okay, cool.
And there's nice hoop benders. If you want to make, like we have a hoop bender for making, I think our smaller hoop houses are 20 feet by 30, I think. And we bought our hoop binner from Johnny's.
Oh, okay.
So it's like a little hoop. You can attach this thing onto the back of your truck, and you just buy like the top rail of fence from, you know, the fence place, and you bend the hoops. It's really satisfying to do because you feel so tough and awesome.
I like those jobs.
Right? So yeah, making the 20 by 30 foot hoops is, like, I think every gardener in Montana should have one. They're not too expensive to build. You're going to get a lot of season extension. It's a great place to put your tomatoes. They're nice. They're really nice.
So what do you mean a hoop bender? What are the hoops made out of? Are they PVC or wood?
Oh, for the size you're talking about, like a 20 by 30 foot hoop house, the hoops can be made out of top rail for chain link fence.
Metal?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, you bend it.
Okay.
I think that's what it was. Jay's probably going to listen to this and be like, that's not what I made this out of. Never mind. You know what? That's what we make our floating row cover hoops out of. But he did have a bender. I don't know. He made them out of something. Something he bought here. Like, you go to the store and you buy the metal for it and you bend it. So this will be the part of the podcast where it's very clear that I do the gardening, Jay does all our projects.
That's okay. Well, let's skip down to harvesting or eating vegetables or fruit all the time. Now, maybe you don't have this problem. You have three little kids. You have two very hungry, working, hardworking people at your house. But for me, it just seems like stuff always comes on all at once. So no matter how hard I try to, like, give it away or, you know, prepare, I still, like, this summer I was, like, determined. And I felt bad for a while. And then I realized I did eat a lot of eggplants. I did eat a lot of zucchinis. It just, now, granted, Mike did plant the mini farm this year, so maybe there was way more than usual. But, like, do you have any tips for eating or harvesting fruit or vegetables on time?
I do. I mean, cool. To me, this is where home gardening is so worth it, because you can get stuff when it's just so fresh. So if you only are going to go out to your garden once a week and have those giant, you know, zucchinis the size of a car, those aren't really fun to eat.
No.
You know, so it's worth it to go to your garden every day or twice a day, maybe sometimes during certain times of the year, and harvest those zucchinis when they're little and they're good and they're better than anything you can buy, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you go out to harvest, or at least to look around your garden every day, mm-hmm. And take some notes and kind of have a mental Rolodex in your head of what's coming on, what's there. I mean, if it's something like garlic scapes, I actually, when the garlic scaping, I walk up and down the garlic rows and harvest scapes twice a day. That's the only thing I do that with. But I really like them to be perfect, you know? And with gardening, that's something that you can do, is you can get food that's beyond anything you could ever buy, you know, that you have to stay on top of harvesting it when it's small and when it's fresh. So, yeah, I'd say harvest at the peak of freshness.
I like that. I do try to get them when they're pretty small. I mean, I put zucchinis on everything. I put them on sandwiches. I put them on pizzas. I put them in eggplants. I mean, and I agree with you that when they're small, they're way better. I don't like a lot of zucchinis get big, because my mom also taught me how to cook the flowers. So I cook the flowers a lot too. So we don't get those big overwhelming, but I don't know. But like I said, this year we had a lot. And then one thing we both decided is we're going to try to invest in a freezer this summer.
Oh, good.
Since we are increasing our production. So how about secrets for preserving food or making it last?
Absolutely. You know, each year I do less and less water bath canning. And I bet, like, someday when I'm got farming really figured out and the kids are all grown up, I bet I'll start doing more again. But I have done less and less every year. What we do a lot of is just storing the food. And how we store our fall crops is we have this nice little, Jay built us a refrigerated trailer that we keep our micro vegetables in. At the end of the season, we just, you know, obviously it doesn't need to be on anymore. We clean it out and we fill it up with root vegetables just in tubs. And so we kind of use that as a cold storage. Mm-hmm. But you don't need to have a special place to keep cold storage vegetables. You don't need to have a root cellar. When we were living in town, I had every bit of our house was like underneath the bed. I kept green tomatoes. I had, like, we had a coat closet that we didn't really use that faced, that was, you know, faced the outside of the house. Mm-hmm. So it was cooler, especially if the door was shut to it. Mm-hmm. And I used to keep potatoes and winter squash in there. And then in the basement, I used to do a lot more canning. I kept all our canned stuff down there. And also in the basement, I used to keep all of our lacto-fermented, like, our sauerkraut and fermented beets and stuff in the basement. Now, I don't do quite as much sauerkraut or fermented beets and carrots, but I do some, and I just keep it in an extra refrigerator. And we do freeze a lot of stuff. Probably one of the coolest things for, like, working mother of three is when the tomatoes are coming on, we are still so busy. So I'll take any tomatoes I bring back from market or any seconds that I don't want to sell, and I just stuff them into food-safe plastic freezer bags. Mm-hmm. Food-safe is really important. Like, plastic already is questionable enough. You have to use food-grade freezer bags.
Okay.
But you can just put the whole tomatoes in a freezer bag and just put them in your freezer. And I get those out, like, stuff really doesn't quiet down for us until November. And I'll make some sauce and stuff in November from those whole frozen tomatoes, because I just don't have time in August and September. So
awesome. I didn't know you could just freeze tomatoes or peppers just straight right in the freezer until I started my podcast this year. Yeah. So.
That's a great, I mean, that's a big game changer to freeze them whole like that.
Yeah. What's your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden for that family?
You know, I'm also a self-taught cook, and I used to look at cookbooks a lot. My favorite cookbook is The Art of Simple Food by Alice Waters.
Oh, nice.
And we all love Alice. I mean, I love Alice Waters. And that cookbook really taught me how to cook with the stuff I grow. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's got like 6 recipes that have arugula in them. It was awesome. But everything in there, once you've kind of read through the book and you've made her soup and her roast chicken, it's all really, really simple. And then, once you know how to do it, you don't need to look at the recipe again. Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite way to cook. So, like, what we eat most of the time is, like, I heat up some of our good pastured lard or tallow. Nice, generous amount in our giant cast iron skillet. I chop up some alliums. And while the alliums are getting beautiful and translucent in that nice big amount of fat, I saute a whole bunch of greens and put them in there. And then I put in whatever else we've got. And you just saute it. And maybe you put some balsamic vinegar or some lemon on that. And serve that big gaggle of awesome stuff on top of potatoes or winter squash. And that's a really good meal. So, you know, when you're working with really simple ingredients that are really high quality, you don't need to do too much to make it the best thing you've ever eaten. But I do like Alice Waters for kind of as a staple cook to know, like, here's a great simple recipe for, you know, wonderful way to make, like, let's see, what's one of the wonderful things? Yeah, her roast chicken. Oh, yeah, put the garlic cloves under the skin. That's a great idea. But everything in there is like that.
That's a good Mike one. Makes her noodles.
Oh, the bread. Eggshell?
She makes this herb cheese bread, I think, from her cookbook. My mom got him one of her cookbooks for Christmas one
nice.
Year. And he cooks a lot of stuff from there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
How about, do you have a favorite place on the internet you like to go for information?
Well, I think the internet, like, as it is, just as a tool, mm-hmm. is an amazing resource. Like, it's crazy to me that you could type in, like, kohlrabi main dish and you're gonna get stuff pop up. You know, so that to me by itself is crazy. Something I do just to kind of expedite the searching for recipes thing on the internet is I'll put in the word nourishing.
Oh.
So, like, if you put in nourishing kohlrabi main dish, I guarantee you that the first, like, ingredients in that recipe is not going to be, like, Cheese Whiz and Ritz crackers. You know what?
Yes.
So, as a kind of keyword for searching for recipes online, I'll just put in, like, you know, nourishing potato souffle, and then it won't have crap ingredients that I have to substitute out. So.
Excellent advice.
Yeah.
More golden potatoes. How about a favorite reading material? Was it that book that you mentioned before? Did you have another one? Or
right now I really like reading the Acres USA magazine. Mm-hmm. And their book list that they always have, that they put out once a year and is up on their website, is amazing for a home gardener, homesteader, or small farmer. They've got just like all the good books seem to be coming out of Acres. So that's a great resource.
Okay. How about, do you have any business advice for listeners about how to like sell extra produce or how to get started? Like, how'd you make your first sale maybe, or anything like that? Or like, did you start with the CSA or start with the farmer's market or both at the same time? Or
I would not start with a CSA. A CSA is a big commitment to your customers. And I'd say if you're a home gardener who wants to sell produce, the first question I would ask myself is, do I really want to sell produce? Or do I just have extra stuff? Because if you just have extra stuff and you don't really want to sell it, you should maybe plan out your succession plantings, you know? Or maybe if you just have a little bit of extra stuff sometimes and you don't really need or want to make money off of it, you might want to find some places you could tithe or gift it to, like the food pantry. But if you really do want to sell it, the best advice I'd say is to keep records of your time and your cost so that right from the beginning, you're not underselling yourself. And it takes years to build up a market base. So I'd say don't be discouraged if you go to market like once and you don't sell anything. You just have to keep going. You have to be there every week. And as a gardener going to someone, going into the place where you're selling stuff, you can't just sell what you would want to eat. You have to sell what you would want to buy. And that's like, just let that sink in. Because us gardeners are used to eating anything that comes out of our garden. You know, it could be a little too big, a little too small. But when you're selling at market, you want to be like the best there is. That's your standard. And anything else really does a disservice to you as a grower. Not so much to the consumer, because they can just get it from another market grower. But I'd say that's like, make sure you want to sell, be patient, keep records, and only sell the best stuff. That's
awesome. Those are perfect.
Thanks.
Okay, ready for the final question?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I'll bet we've been talking for a while. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel, Mandy, is the most crucial issue facing our planet regarding the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Okay. So my favorite ag charity is Heifer International.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Yeah, they train farmers in the developing world with ecologically sound farming practices and help them get started. And they're using all natural regenerative practices. It's really awesome. So that's a great cause. But I think, like, for us, it's a big question. Like, just to know that there's not, like, a single technology or government or policy, or it's basically something out there in the big wide world that needs to happen for positive global change. Like, there is a global food movement happening and we're all a part of it. Everybody here is listening to your awesome podcast.
Oh,
you know, and we all know that soil health is directly connected to human health, and soil health is so full and just brimming over with health and promise. And there's farmers willing to dedicate their lives to growing this food. And there's people willing to dedicate their time to growing this food. If whether it's like one little bitty plant or acres, it's all awesome. And it's all like, it's already here. So I think that's something really important for us to put our focus on, is that we've got answers. We don't need to wait for something else to happen.
Excellent. Oh, you have been just the most amazing guest.
Oh, thanks.
So do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach? I don't know. That was pretty good just right there. I'm not even going to ask that final question unless you have something written that you really want to share.
I do have something written. Okay. You can always cut it out.
Okay.
I think if you think that you can't grow your own food, you can. Okay. And like every seed that doesn't germinate and every bug that eats your stuff, that's not a failure. That's just an opportunity to learn something, and it's there to teach you, and you can grow food, and it's worth it to do it. So that's all.
That was perfect. You were so wonderful. I mean it. You're going to be one of the, I know you're going to be in the top downloaded episodes before you know it. And so my show has been growing, and you're going to help. You just taught a lot of people a lot of basic but important things for people to think about, and inspired people that they can do this. And tell them how they can connect with you. How do they find the Lower Valley Farm? Do they go to Facebook? You guys have a blog?
Yes, we have. We're on Facebook. It's like Facebook/Lower Valley Farm. And we also have lowervalleyfarm.com. And we're on Instagram, and we have a telephone. And so, yeah, we have lots of ways to find us.
Cool. And you're at the Kalispell Farmers Market on Saturday mornings?
We're there every week. Yes.
Thank you so, so, so very much for taking time away from your kids on a Saturday and just sharing with us your amazing knowledge. And we all wish you the best. And congratulations for winning the 2015 CrossFit Gardener of the Year.
You're cracking me up. You're welcome. Aww. Winner. <Okay. laughs>